and Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour on this May the 13th on the West Coast, now May the 14th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zones. Lots going on within the past 24 hours, a lot of flip-flopping going on with Barack Obama. I guess we could call it Barky's ping pong. Jeff Rentz likes to call him Barky. I guess that's a nickname for Barack. Anyway, the flip-flopping has to do with this issue of releasing the photographs of the torture that has been occurring in regard to all of these so-called terrorists that have been arrested. And there have been congressional hearings in regard to this. Of course, this is all a dog and pony show to divert attention away from all the corruption going on. And that in and of itself is corruption, don't get me wrong. But the financial corruption going on. There have been numerous attempts to fund all the programs, we'll call them, financial programs through banks across the country and in foreign countries throughout the world. And it's been discovered that that gold, Japanese gold, that was supposedly being monitored and under safekeeping of the U.S. Treasury has been stolen. And because of that, and you're already familiar with the bailout, so you can assume this is all part of the same financial corruption. And that deals with stocks and offshore accounts and the whole nine yards, including the Treasury, which it's alleged is holding counterfeit money, shrink-wrapped, to be put out into the world as repayment for all the debt, which is really the discovery of the stolen funds. So if you think you have it bad here, trust me, this is going on all over the world. And we're getting various reports that this is being curtailed and that finally people are going to start receiving their money. But you've got a tremendous amount of corruption going on, and you're getting the change you were promised, although it's not in the package you assumed it was going to be in. That said, we'll move on to tonight's guest. He is a biblical and constitutional scholar and has been directly involved in let's say, arriving at some remedies for this straw man concept. Your contractual obligations under the capital United States of America. And he has been on the show a number of times now and has also appeared on Frank Whalen's internet radio show, as well as the Road Warrior radio show on Republic Broadcasting Network. And, of course, we like to have him here on BBS Radio as well. He's my good friend, Mr. Greg Pappas. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don, very much. It's an honor and a pleasure to be on with you tonight. I think we're going to have some fun.
Oh, yes, if you can call it that. What else can we do with this insanity but have fun with it, right? Because
That's right.
I think we're coming to a time when all of this is going to stop, and it's actually not even going to be part of our consciousness or our memory, I think. I think it's going to be so completely expunged it won't be allowed to exist in a higher vibration or a higher dimension. I got a note here, Greg, if you can make sure you speak up
so we have
the levels that we had earlier. Okay.
Do you want me to switch back to the other telephone, or is this going to be loud enough now?
Well, as long as... As long as you just maintain a close contact with it, I think it'll work. Yeah.
Okay. Seth said it sounds great now.
Okay.
Okay, good. Good.
Okay. Well, I'll allow you to open up the topic. I mean, I kind of opened the door of, you know, that we've got this dichotomy here. We have all this corruption, and at the same time, we're expected to adhere to laws which are really not unconstitutional, aren't they?
Absolutely. Completely across the board. That is part of the fun discussion I wanted to have is that everybody seems to be afraid of all these new laws and all these laws that have been passed and how they're going to enforce them on us. And I and a few of my friends now, I think you're probably going to be part of this group too, will be sitting back laughing at all these ridiculous laws that they're passing because they're all unenforceable on true people, on real people. They're only enforceable on people who are really legal fictions or at least living their lives in the realm of legal fiction. So, yes, this is a remarkable time, Don.
And I would venture to guess that that's not very different from a TV reality show, right? The characters on that are equal to the fiction, the fictionalized persona you're describing.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, it's like somebody has made a caricature of all of us and written a bunch of laws to enforce upon the caricature, and somehow all of us living, breathing, flesh and blood, spirits of God are running around in a state of panic going, oh my, they're going to apply this to me, they're going to apply this to me. And when we should be sitting back going, this is hysterically funny, or it's hysterically insane, or it's hysterically insane that these people actually think they're going to enforce this upon flesh and blood people when it only is written for the legal fiction. Maybe we better go into some detail here in a bit and explain what we're talking about.
if I can just preface what we're about to delve into with a recap of Monday night's show. I had the national spokesperson for AmericanGrandJury.org, Sam Sewell, on the show. And we got into a very, very serious discussion about the citizens' grand juries. Now, this is a remedy that I've been aware of for some time, and if I recall, I have mentioned this a couple of times on the show. I couldn't begin to tell you what date that I did that, but I can say that that the concept is not foreign to me. I'm very familiar with it, and that's exactly the constitutional principle that this group is operating under. Now, in respect to that, I feel it's important what you bring to the show, because they, even though they're exercising a constitutional right, must look at this information that you're going to share with the listening audience tonight in that respect, as if they were just one person going before the court. It doesn't matter if it's one person, two people, or millions being represented by an organization. The same rules apply.
That's exactly how I see it, Don. This game that they've created. In other words, like, and I don't know any details about the group you just spoke about, just from what you told me, and I have from you and your broadcast. But I do know that this system that they're operating under today is completely predicated on an illusion. And the illusion is that this government today is operating as if it operates under the Constitution, the original government. In fact, I heard something today, Don, I'm going to throw this out real quick, and I haven't checked this out completely, but I heard it on a popular radio show that Teddy Roosevelt was considered a progressive, and the man that ran against him, Woodrow Wilson, was a progressive, and that both of them had plans to completely unravel all the work of the founding fathers of this country. In other words, to eliminate any semblance of anything that Jefferson and Madison and Patrick Henry and Benjamin Franklin and John Adams and those guys put together. And I was thinking, now that was 100 years ago, because I know and now we're talking about a transition. Well, boy, howdy! You know, I think it'd be surprising now if anybody actually believed in other words, that there really was a general holding to the Constitution. In other words, anybody that is thinking that there's a Constitution operating out in the open, in the courts and in the government and your local sheriff's department and, you know, mm-hmm. your local planning, my comment to that is there's something. In other words, it's been gone for so long. We were born in an illusion that it was there, but it was gone long before any of us were born.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were to address that illusion a little bit, I'd kind of like to tap into that just for a moment to what happened. And
yeah.
I don't have that article in front of me, the one that's supposedly attributed to Senator Harkin called about his IRS knowledge, but I have pretty much got it memorized. And in this instrument, it appears that not only has Lee Brobst, but others, including at least a letter that's supposedly attributable to Senator Harkin, we haven't been able to get this verified or not, that in 1933, the people in this country gave up their gold, and giving up their gold gave up their law. And that law was the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And that would be the beginning point. And of course, most of us were not alive. And if we were, if anybody's listening, they were probably quite young when this all transitioned. And by 1938, with the decision of the Erie Railroad versus Tompkins, everything changed from any semblance of a general federal common law to one under this unincorporated association. So, and let me just give a preface to this. In 1811, there's a Supreme Court case, Justice Marshall, and you guys can Google this thing, and if you can't find it, send me an email, and I'll try to forward it if I ever get to my emails again. It's William Dixon versus United States. It's an 1811 Supreme Court decision, Justice Marshall, and in this case, Justice Marshall states several times that the United States of America is the grand old corporation. And it was a grand old corporation created by the people for the people. And that it could own property and it could sell property. It can sue and be sued and operates just like original corporations were intended to be controlled by the people. But it was a corporation nonetheless. In 1933, when the gold was given up and the law was removed, something happened in the law, and it was based on the Constitution, and it's Article 4, Section 3, Subsection 1, or Paragraph 1 and 2. And Paragraph 2, theoretically, according to the work of Lee Brobst and according to this letter by Senator Harkin, the people became victims of an unincorporated association, or as some men call it, a foreign, private, unincorporated, implied charitable trust. And really what happened was the 14th Amendment, which had been passed in 1868, was now becoming applicable to every man, woman, and child in the country, unless the people rebutted it with evidence. And even in the Senator Harkin letter, he doesn't explain what that evidence is, but I believe we've discovered what that is. So what I'm saying is that this foreign, private, unincorporated, implied charitable trust, or as Lee Brobst abbreviates it, an unincorporated association, was created. It's kind of like Freemasonry and your local church on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
I'd
like to comment on that whole definition that you just gave. And let's just use charitable trust, okay? We put into the trust, but we don't get anything out of it. I find that kind of interesting. That's basically
because we're the beneficiaries. That's because we're declared to receive benefits, and we're no longer the beneficiaries like we were under the original corporation. But yes,
that's like bread and water, and
right.
maybe a cardboard shack.
That's right.
Okay, go ahead. I'm being a bit facetious, but in principle, I think that's what's intended.
You're exactly right. you've got it. That's the irony. Everybody's desperate now to hold on to some benefits. That is a perfect illustration. Everybody's desperate to hold on to a benefit. They want their Social Security benefit, or they want their government pension, or their military pension, or something else. And yet, all the while, everybody's ignored the fact that, wait a minute, if I get a benefit, I'm no longer the beneficiary. So what's happened is, it's like owning a car. It used to be you had title, you had the manufacturer's statement of origin on the automobile, but now the manufacturer's statement of origin or manufacturer's certificate of origin, depending on what state you're in, they call it, it goes to the state. You never see it. You never touch it when you go to buy a brand new car. It immediately goes to the state, and the state takes control, and you get the benefit of being able to use the car you just bought.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, the state controls it or really has ownership, and then yet supposedly according to this trust that they've set up, we're responsible to pay the insurance and make sure we take care of all the upkeep. If you look at this thing really close, it looks like a really bum raw deal that we've really been had. But for some reason, Don, everybody's running around worrying about this government as if it's a real government, and these guys that run this thing, they know. Now, even if this letter from Senator Harkin is not genuine, I must tell you, if when a guy becomes elected senator or U.S. House of Representatives, we know that they go to school back there. Now, none of us have been invited to go to that school and to learn what it is they're actually being taught, but I can almost guarantee you 100% that by the time somebody gets into the Senate or the House of Representatives, like a Ron Paul who's been there, over 22 years in the past 32 years, they know that we are not operating under the Constitution. They know we're operating under this charitable trust, which
mm-hmm.
is defined in the 14th Amendment, where the language is all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to. When you have the word "and subject to," that is trust language. Yet that was only supposed to apply to free black slaves of the Southern combatants. That's an 1871 California Supreme Court decision. And then it was applied in the 1870s and 1880s to Native Americans, and then to other immigrants, and then by 1933, so nobody would feel left out, all Americans, by the Erie Railroad versus Tompkins case of 1938, were deemed to be 14th Amendment citizens. And that is, by not rebutting that, or not showing evidence as to the contrary of that, we've all been presumed to be. And I guess I better state what the first bit of evidence that the government uses to justify their position. And by the way, when you walk into a court, Don, the judge isn't going to stand up and say, "I have jurisdiction over you because of the following." He's not going to list what I'm about ready to tell you.
Yes.
So it's like a cat and mouse game. What we're going
to
say
let's ask the listening audience to get their pens and papers and take notes of this. This is important stuff.
Oh, yes. This is, and then I'm not the source for all this information, so I better cite some of my sources. One of them is a man in Canada. Now, this information I have right now is partly my research and partly the research of other men like Lee Brobst and like Dennis Craig Bynum and like a man out of Canada named Vic Beck or Victor Robert Beck. I've gotten this from, and I've probably got a number of sources that I'm not citing right now, but I've researched through a lot of men's and women's research through the years. So what I'm going to say right now is predicated on several things, but I'm going to start with the birth certificate. And,
okay.
The birth certificate, which is the first instrument that's generated when we're born, is the one that starts this whole thing. And according to Vic Beck up in Canada, it's the one that the government uses to presume jurisdiction over us regarding our name. So let me start with a foundational point with the instrument itself. I have it on some pretty good authority from people that have worked in the administrations of several hospitals that hospitals are paid anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 per birth certificate. Now, we've all been led to believe you can't leave the hospital without a birth certificate, like there's some law there. But I guarantee you, Don, there is no law.
Well, in the case of Barack Obama, there's some hospitals around the world that have been shafted out of that money, haven't there?
I guess so. But from Kenya to Indonesia to Hawaii, huh?
Yeah, and points beyond. There may be a hospital in Mars suffering, too, you know.
Well, I've got a story for you about that here in a minute that I think relates to that. I heard a guy call it the other day. They were discussing your work and another man's work on the Barack Obama thing. And this guy calls in and says, "I have a nephew. I know he was born in the United States because I know all his family. I know his mother and father. They're relatives. And I know he was born here. But for some reason, something happened with his birth certificate or something, and it was lost or wasn't done right or something. Anyways, this young man, who was obviously an American, obviously born, I think, within the 48 contiguous states, he was trying to join the Marine Corps. This is hysterically funny if you actually think about this. And the Marines, even though they could obviously see he was an American, and he was a white American born within the 48 contiguous states, because his birth certificate was somewhat in question, even though it really wasn't, the family members would come in and swear to it, everything else, he couldn't join the Marine Corps. Now, the father that called in, the uncle that called in about this was incredulous. He was, and it was, I started laughing so hard, I was thinking about you, because he said, now, think about this. This young man is obviously born in the United States. Obviously, he's got relatives to prove it. We've all served in the military. And he can't join the Marine Corps, yet his commander-in-chief can't even prove if he was born on this planet.
Yes. How right, how prophetic that statement was.
I know. Anyway, so I just thought I had to throw that out there since we're dealing about birth certificates. So.
Yeah. Well, I didn't mean to throw you off track there. It just hit me like a ton of bricks, you know, that some hospitals got their hand out. Well, you know, they want their $5,000 or $10,000.
Mm-hmm. Oh, can you imagine with all the babies that are born in hospitals? These hospitals are, you know, it could keep the records department or other departments going with all the money they're pulling in. Okay, so let's get to our birth certificates.
Yes.
Now,
okay.
Birth certificates have changed since 1920. It's either 21, 23 or 26 when they became standardized across the country. But it was 1933 where birth certificates first were the key to operating this unincorporated association or this charitable trust. And the birth certificate, if you'll look at your birth certificate, it'll have a father's name and his occupation, mother's name, and I'm not sure if it has occupation all the time, but it will have a line for the mother to sign the instrument. But there won't be a line for the father to sign the instrument. And underneath the mother's name will generally have the word informant underneath there, which I always found quite comical in light of our past condemnations of the Soviet Union and all the informants that they supposedly were experiencing. So the word informant is there, but the father doesn't sign it. That's the key. And under the Latin phrase parens, P-A-R-E-N-S, patriae, P-A-T-R-A-E-I, or A-E-I, I'm not sure about the spelling. It should be in your Black's Law Dictionary. I found it in a Black's 6th edition today. According to Parens Patriae, the king is the father. And in the case of the United States, it says that the state as sovereign is father. Well, I find that very profound. Black's 6th edition Law Dictionary was the 100th anniversary. It came out in 1991. And that's claiming, and so when you have a father not sign the birth certificate, in essence, I think the other phrase is pater familias, another Latin phrase, but under parens patriae, the state is the father. And it couldn't be more appropriate in light of this country transitioning from a constitutional republic for the vast majority of the people to a unincorporated association, charitable trust, that we've been tricked into. So the first step is that after 45 days when this instrument is created, it goes from the hospital to the Department of Vital Statistics in your county and state. From there, it goes to the Department of Commerce. From there, to the Depository Trust Corporation, where then the business of the world now is set in motion as to how much commercial product is going to be produced based on that birth certificate.
Mm-hmm.
As that's factored based on what your father's occupation. So if your father's a medical doctor, you're going to have a higher value than if your father's working for the dog pound or something, you know. If he's working for the county versus an MV or, you know, it depends mm-hmm. on his profession.
Now, the mother, the issue of the mother and that space that they always include, mother's maiden name, there's a definite sign that the name itself is the important issue there, that it's attached. In other words, they have to be able to carry that catalog item, that line item, that individual line item, over to the family, in other words. So
yeah, they want to be able to trace it. Yeah, this is definitely for commercial purposes.
Yes,
it's only for. It has nothing to do with. It's to verify both bloodlines, to run the line, but it's for commercial reasons. I don't know, really, in all fairness, this thing's been kept such a secret about how the bond world works. We really do need somebody within the bond world, somebody who works for A.G. Edwards or one of the big bond houses or used to work for one of the big bond houses, to come out and really, even if you want to go off the record, talk to Don or myself, and you really need to give us the breakdown. Anybody who's worked for the Depository Trust Corporation or for the Department of Commerce and has actually tracked these instruments when they come in from the various departments of vital statistics. We'd really love to hear from people from all these departments, if at all possible, to give us the specific details. We have rough sketches as the tracing of these, but it would really be nice to see how it's monetized and somebody who actually could set a value on it. We estimate the conservative value on each birth certificate is around $500,000, upwards of $1 million, between $500,000 and $1 million, with the average being around $700,000. But go ahead.
The issue of the Depository Trust Corporation was brought up on this show several times over the past year, even through the past few months, and their association with Seed and Company, and this has to do with they're the recipients of stock contracts, stock purchases, buyouts, put options, whatever. And I would presume that includes derivatives and hedge funds. And it's part of the Federal Reserve. And it's the DTCC actually clears the checks that the banks are issued. So when you write a check, it goes through them. And they retain that money, you know, because there's really no actual exchange of money going on. This is all just checks and balances of the worth of the particular individual and actually how much commerce they're generating. So
exactly.
And I think their address is 55 Water Street in New York.
Yeah.
They have a building where all this occurs. And so when people think that they own stock, actually, you know, they can just take the stock because on some level a broker has convinced them, oh, you know, your information is here. You know, we have all this. We give it to Seed and Company for safekeeping, when in reality that's the beginning of the scam right there. Unless you are actually holding these stocks in physical possession, it belongs to them, surreptitiously, I might add. So I just wanted to bring out those points for the listener.
Well, absolutely, that is the key. Well, that is where the actual day-to-day transactions are taking place. But the initiation of the funding of this thing, this perpetual funding of obviously continuous new births. You know, even we've talked about this before, I think. So let's look at the terms about somebody being born. You come down the birth canal, and you're delivered to the dock, or delivered by the dock tour.
After the water breaks.
After the water breaks.
Yes.
Right. So it's all naval, commercial sea, commerce law of the sea, admiralty law. And then, of course, when the instrument is created, the birth certificate, your straw man, your legal fiction is launched onto a sea of commerce. And within 45 days, if the father does not capture that back and say, wait a minute, this child's not illegitimate. We're not going to deal with Prince Patrier. We're going to deal with me as the father. This is not an illegitimate child launched onto a sea of commerce, which none of us knew to do, by the way. I didn't know. That child is launched, and that name then, according to Vic Beck, and I believe this to be true based on a court case from last summer, that the court then takes control of the name. Now, we used to think that they only took control of the name in all capital letters, whether it was first name, middle name, last name, or last name, first name, middle name, but we found out that these guys think they control the name no matter how it's written. Now, according to the birth certificate, based on the fact that the instrument was put out there, went through the whole process that we spoke about earlier, and was not captured back by the father, making the child free again back under the Constitution. So, and by the way, there's a chance at any time in our lives you want to get back, but after 18 years old, a child can do it themselves. They don't have to have their parents' permission to come out of commerce. But, of course, we're all led to believe we have to have the Social Security number and that birth certificate and be in this set for this commercial world. Otherwise, we won't be able to get that job at McDonald's. So, anyways.
Well, but that doesn't mean that a six-month-old can't be extricated with the help of, let's say, their guardian, their parent.
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. We could do this for our kids. Yes.
Or a newborn, for that matter. Yes.
And the newborn right away, absolutely. And there's people, by the way, there are people living in this country that do not have birth certificates, and they are not bound by this. But most of them still haven't known what it was or how they could make sure that they were operating under the Constitution and not under this unincorporated, implied charitable trust. So,
yeah.
Okay, so we've got these people, we've got us all launched on this commerce, and literally this whole system is operating on this. So, you know, in other words, the whole commercial world, and it's continually building off of us, whether, for example, if there's performance bonds, there's all types of bonds in the bond world. And we hear these words, we don't even know what they mean. Like there's a prison bond. Somebody's arrested and they're convicted and they're going to go to sentencing for a crime. They're going to go to prison. Well, a prison bond is created for that. A bond is created when they're first arrested. When you get a traffic ticket, they need you to sign the ticket. Well, at least in some states, they say you don't even need to sign it anymore. They're just making the presumption. But that traffic ticket, which let's say it's a $100 ticket, that can be monetized for $1,000. So when you sign that ticket with the cop on the side of the road, he signs it, you sign it, it's now with the two signatures, becomes a commercial instrument. That goes out there in the bond world. Who knows how much money that thing's monetized for? It appears these guys will make a bond on just about anything. You know, we heard that a DA can indict a ham sandwich. It appears they can indict, or they can create bonds on every last thing we do. And before I forget, Don, I was going to tell you about a case that relates to the name, and I'm going to forget unless I say it now. A friend of mine was in court. Now, this man is not a slouch when it comes to scholarship of the law. He's written a series of books on the Errant Sovereign's Handbooks. I forgot what the series, all the different titles of all the books are. But he was in court last summer in Spokane, Washington. And in the courthouse, the first time he was in court, and he'd been arrested, stopped in a setup, a sting stop, where I think four or five or six squad cars stopped him with like eight cops, and they played with him, and in other words, they basically played a game with him until they could beat the crap out of him, and they beat him up.
Greg. Make sure you speak up. Yeah.
Okay, I'll backtrack for a second. Anyways, this friend of mine, who's a well-known author on the law, was arrested last summer in a sting operation actually after he left the courthouse, and they pulled him over, and it became a very stressful situation that ensued. And they happened to catch him when he was by himself and none of his friends were with him. And they ended up trying to take his eye out with some glass, broken glass. But when he was in court, and I'm not saying he handled the procedures correct, but when he was in court, he discussed that the court did not have jurisdiction, either regular jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction at all, that they had no jurisdiction over him whatsoever. The first time he was in the court, and this was in front of a female judge, she let him speak, and it appeared that he was actually getting his way. They set for the next hearing. He went back into court. He started to make the same explanations that they didn't have, that she didn't have subject matter jurisdiction. And this, I was not there, but I have several friends of mine that were eye and ear witnesses to this. And they heard her say to him, you're not going to go through that again today unless you do it the last time you were in court. Today, we're going to get right to the matter of the business of this issue here. And I'm going to say this now, and I want you to listen to me. I have jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction over you today. I had it the last time you were in court. I had it the day that you were arrested, and I've had it every day of your life since the day you were born. Now, my friend did not react to that, but all my other friends that were in the courtroom were taken aback, knowing what we know about the birth certificate. That had to be referring to the birth certificate and the registration of the name, and the government, even though it's operating under an unincorporated implied charitable trust, is presuming to have jurisdiction over that name. And if we don't somehow rebut that presumption with evidence, they're going to latch that name onto whoever's standing in that courtroom, and make it all apply to them. Now, that's what happened to my friend, and that, I believe, is what ties in with this whole issue of the bond situation that runs the finances of this world.
Let me interject with a question here. How old is this judge, or how long has she been a judge?
Oh, this was not an old judge. This woman was probably in her late 40s, and the man who was in front of her was in his early 60s.
Okay, so she told the court a lie, didn't she, when she made that statement? I have had jurisdiction over you.
Right, right.
Since the day you were born.
She's not even older than him. Right.
Yes,
right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a lie. A lie is a lie.
It's a lie.
I would have brought that point up.
By saying, yeah. She could have said that this court has jurisdiction over you, and this court or this government has had jurisdiction over you since the day you were born.
Yeah, it becomes a different issue. She has to play her cards, or she has to show her cards, doesn't she, and to make that statement. I would have challenged her statement right there.
Oh, right. Well, I agree. And I think when I spoke with you before, that's right. We agreed that that's something he should have done. He
yes.
should have challenged it. And he didn't. It's clearly he did not challenge it. And I can only tell you that the reason I'm using that app tied in with what I know about the birth certificate being a registration of the name into the hands of those that operate this phony government.
Mm-hmm.
It's just to show that they've come out and they've said this publicly. This mm-hmm. is not the first time this has been said in the courtroom where a judge
yeah.
is presumed to have jurisdiction.
Well, I most likely would have said, well, you're the one that held me upside down by the ankles and smacked me on my rear end. You got one coming.
Yeah. Take that man in contempt of court. Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, well, even then, it wouldn't even be the doctor. Because all the doctor did was he signed the instrument, but he's not the one that turned it into the commercial instrument. It was this process that we talked about.
The hospital, yes.
But this whole thing is all part of the illusion that they've so elaborately set up.
Yeah. Well, if this occurs, let's pause just for a second and discuss this hospital thing. If the hospitals do this because they get a kickback of money and you know, the first question one should ask is, where does that money come from? Where did that money, you know, is it made out of thin air also? Likely that's the answer, right? There really isn't an actual transfer of tangible assets, if they're dealing with Federal Reserve notes or contracts or whatever. You know, it's some obligation or some promise for the future. What happens in the case of a stillborn some liability that the hospital incurs because of malpractice or something like that? In other words, the baby dies. You know, how do they treat that?
The only thing I understand is that the child is born alive. I know a birth certificate is created, and if a child dies, even there in the hospital, that a death certificate is generated, and I believe those are still sent through to the Department of Vital Statistics. The hospital is still paid, and that is still monetized for its
mm-hmm.
initial amount, but then it's immediately withdrawn. I don't know if it's sold on the bond market, but I do believe that they'll even take those and monetize those, but I can't prove that.
They treat it like a sunken ship, maybe to be retrieved later on by some recovery team on
a
National Geographic show.
That's brilliant that you would say that, because that gets back to the whole concept of this unincorporated implied charitable trust using limited liability. In other words, the reason this really ties all up. That what you said there is a good tie-in, because when we receive the benefits, we're saying that we want limited liability instead of accepting all liability and living moral, righteous lives under the golden rule. And so, in essence, what's happened is we all are sharing in. We share all of our assets with everybody else because we want limited liability. And so this whole system is predicated on this limited liability. And that started with ship owners trying to not lose all the loss. If their ship sank with all their cargo on it, they were trying to spread the risk out amongst other ship owners whose ships didn't sink. So they'd all
mm-hmm.
pay a piece so you wouldn't lose everything. And that's where this whole concept is derived from. Now the whole country operates under a limited liability. And in essence, Don, I think what's happened is this financial bailout for like B of A, this other $35 billion that they want and all this other stuff, I believe, at least the theory would go, that this is also being monetized based on this ever-expanding birth certificates or this ever-expanding debt. Because, again, as long as the people continue to accept limited liability and receive benefits instead of acting as the beneficiaries of the original corporation of the United States of America, these guys are going to be able to keep operating the scam and keep enslaving us and imprisoning us at the rates that are unheard of.
Well, it also includes, I mean, it expands into the public realm, the public funding, such as schools and publicly owned properties, parks, and the communities themselves. This it goes beyond the person, is what I'm saying, and it encompasses everything. And I can track this directly to the mortgage scam, the whole, you know, the foreclosures, repos, the whole nine yards. All of that's part of the same scam.
It does, because it keeps the world going. You can see the evidence of this now. They ran the prices of the houses outrageous. People then walked or were foreclosed on. They take these places and they resell them for maybe even 20% of what the last time it sold for, 25%. Takes a 75% cut. They don't care. They still got the process going. The people operating the escrow, the people operating the title, the people operating the foreclosure process in the courts and in the banks. These people all have jobs. They're still working. And in other words, as long as we don't, each of us individually, rebut the erroneous evidence that we are 14th Amendment slaves, that we are under this unincorporated implied charitable trust, under this 14th Amendment and this presumption with the birth certificate and all the other things that have followed as a result of that, these people are going to continue to do to us whatever they want. And, Don, that's why I said that all the grand juries and all the other arguments on all the various shows are now, as far as I see them, all irrelevant, worrying about any laws that they pass. Because if those of us that choose to be free and to go get out of this unincorporated implied charitable trust, and go back under the Republic, we will be able to make valid claims again against this system. Oh, and by the way, Don, in that little two-page deal that's been attributed to Senator Harkin on his IRS knowledge, he even cites the remedy. The remedy was given to us in 1976. It's the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which I think was preceded with, let's see, it's Title 28 of the United States Code, and it started with Section 1746, subsections 1 and 2, and then it, about a week or two later was when the full act was enacted, and that was with Title 28, United States Code, Section 1602 to 1611, and I believe there's several follow-ups. There's Section 1330, Section 1332, and Section 1442. I believe there's a couple more, but those are the ones I know off the top of my head, and I know those directly relate to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And I'm going to say something that totally contradicts a lot of my early law studies, but this is what I'm going to say right now is the absolute truth. Article 3 courts of the Constitution, which are under Admiralty Maritime Law, are nothing to be afraid of. We were led to believe through various phony teachers over the past 20 years that Admiralty Maritime Law is something to be feared. It's only to be feared if we're ignorant. But once we've made our way out of being the presumed 14th Amendment citizen of the United States citizen of this unincorporated implied charitable trust, we make it back to the Republic. The Article III court there of the District Court of the United States of America is where our remedy is, I believe. And I would like to, this is a remedy for the guys that want to find a way to force, you know, certain aspects of this government to come out in the open. The remedy is going to be, if that individual who makes that claim against whatever issue it is, it binds the people that come after us under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And I believe from what the evidence appears, this is the one thing that the dark side that operates this phony government is afraid of. They're afraid that they could actually be dragged in to under Article 3 court, which is at the District Court of the United States of America under Admiralty Maritime Law, where they would have no remedy. And the reason, Don, that I say they would have no remedy in contrast to us having a remedy is based on the following. If we rebutted the presumption of them controlling our names and our lives through that birth certificate by making them produce evidence of them having control over that, in other words, showing on that instrument that my signature's on there or your signature's on there, which they cannot do, obviously, we didn't sign it.
Yes.
We did not sign it. Therefore, we could make the evidence that we are outside of that presumption, while the men and women who operate within these various agencies that are attacking us can only work for those agencies if they are 14th Amendment United States citizens of this unincorporated implied charitable trust.
Now, here's an interesting sidelight to that. Barack Obama is then exercising that privilege, but that does not qualify him to be president. He's actually declared himself sovereign from that, right?
Yes.
So yes, how can he be the president then? Just under that one point.
He's really only, from what I can see, in a way that I went through the tapes of the inauguration, he is only the president of the United States. He is not the president of a constitutional republic, the United States of America, the grand old corporation, as is cited in William Dixon versus United States, 1811 decision. I believe that what we have here is a man who, regardless of his background, is only the head of a corporation, an unincorporated implied charitable trust,
mm-hmm.
It's run itself out of D.C. They're in the Congress. They have a State of the Union address, and they hold their board of directors meeting with the both houses of Congress and the justices of the Supreme Court and the Cabinet and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But that all those people there are all window dressing of an unincorporated implied charitable trust. And by the way, it's also foreign and private. And this is where I think Lee Brobst has nailed this thing completely, because if he's right, and Thomas Jefferson, and by the way, I haven't read this yet, but I have some friends that are reading his autobiography, and if maybe they can find a copy of that, or if it's online, let me know. I'd like to see a copy of Thomas Jefferson's autobiography. But according to a friend of mine who's reading it, he said that what Lee Brobst has said is correct in Jefferson's own words, and that in 1760, when Lord Mansfield in England transitioned the British Parliament from under a common law to where it was taken over and controlled under private Roman law, private municipal law or Roman civil law. There we go. Private Roman civil law, private municipal law. The country that was founded here was founded on public municipal law. But because of this clause under Article 4, Section 3, Paragraph 2, the door was left open for these unincorporated associations. And that was what Franklin was referring to when he was asked, what kind of a government have you given us? Well, he said, a republic, if you can keep it. He was referring to the fact that they left the door open for these unincorporated associations, whether it's the Roman Catholic Church or Freemasonry or whatever it is, to come in here and set up shop. Because, as according to Jefferson and according to some of the others, they indicated that if they did not leave this door opening, that they would say that they would have been setting up their own dictatorship. They had to give the people an opportunity to screw themselves if they wanted to give up their rights and to give up their law. And that's what's happened.
Yes, but that's not been explained to us. So we never really were offered the choice, let's say.
No,
and the fact that we haven't signed that original document referred to as the certificate of live birth or birth certificate, I think that's the birth certificate. And then the certificate of live birth is the actual registration of that document.
I believe you're right.
Yes. So, but in both cases, it's called a certificate. It implies maritime law. And now they call it the law of the land. Isn't that interesting? Because the law of the land mirrors the law of the sea. There's no difference.
Right. Right, because, in fact, oh my gosh, even Lee talked about the fact that there's on all your administrative buildings and throughout the country and your various counties, they all have a high water mark built onto them, and it's above the records department where their vital statistics are originally kept. The water mark on the buildings is always above the floor where the records are at. The records are always below the water mark. So, yeah, They're telling us right up front in every county that they've operated the whole thing now under Admiralty Maritime. Yeah, the law of the sea. It's everywhere. The sea is, there's even high water marks on mountains, I believe, in various parts of the country where the high point is a mountain, and they've made a mark there, either a placard or a marquee or something, on all over the country where they show the high water mark.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's where then the Uniform Commercial Code comes into play then.
Right, and the law merchant being codified, yeah.
Yes. Okay.
But I'm not sure we have to worry about that so much in our way out. It's the way they operate in their commercial world, but I think we can find our way out without worrying about the UCC anymore.
Yeah, I'm not implying in any way that we should worry about it. It's just another element of how they've taken everything that is manufactured or grown and bought or sold or traded or you know whatever however it's transacted into the economy. It's their way of categorizing it. That's why we have these digital strips on all the products that are sold, and they even have a way of getting it onto fruits and vegetables. You know, if they're packaged a certain way.
Oh, I believe it.
You know, the barcode. Yeah.
I got something I just remembered now that you said that. Oh my gosh, 13 years ago, I was at the Claremont College's Law Library in Southern California. In San Bernardino County. And I remembered, oh my gosh, I totally forgot about that. A friend of mine and I got into a section that I guess ordinarily you're not supposed to get into. And we found a wall it was a record kept of American commerce, but it was a British record of American commerce from 1791. And I forgot, I think at that time the books that we found there went until like the 1980s or 1990s. I found this in around 1997. And I'm telling you, to this day, I don't know why I forgot about this. It was literally the British keeping a complete record of all of American commerce. Now, why would the British want a record of American commerce, and what was it doing in an American university law school library?
Well, I swear. King George III financed this whole thing from the beginning,
right?
You brought up Teddy Roosevelt, and I think it's worth bouncing back to that just for a brief moment. You brought up his role implying that his intention was to pull all this off. Actually, it would have been about 109, 110 years ago. I think he took office in 1899 following the McKinley assassination. And he had rather, I don't recall the exact comment, but he made sort of a sarcastic comment like how would, McKinley wasn't involved in some corruption or something. How would he have been involved in it? And in my tracking of the McCain clan, which is really the McCann clan, the offspring of Edward, Prince Albert Edward, who became Edward VII. That was when he made his big move, bringing his descendants into the U.S. Navy surreptitiously. And the shipping company or the shipping lines, of which there were two, were owned by Teddy Roosevelt, registered under his son Kermit's name. And the major shipping line was the United States Lines.
Yes.
So I just wanted to point that out. That's in, I covered that in The Three Stooges Go to Washington, Part 2, by the way. So
okay.
For reference.
So that shows the, well, it shows more of the transition out from one type of a society to another, and these people have, it's there. It's all in front of us. In fact, we know the Roosevelt, I mean, that's one, there was a thing on PBS, a special done on the Roosevelts, various segments of the family from Teddy Roosevelt to Franklin Roosevelt to Eleanor Delano's family. But in each of the cases, they left out the major part. Where did these rich families make their wealth to live in the Hyde Park of New York and the wealthy parts of the country? They always left that out. Isn't that funny? And yet, I believe that all three families were all involved in the same trade, and that was the opium trade in the Orient.
I was going to say that the shipping and the smuggling of illegal drugs and weapons for war, and the gold that was transacted. It's always about the money, and we have centuries of the theft of the world's gold that supported the economy internationally.
Absolutely. Now, isn't it funny though, Don? Here we are tonight. We're literally, you know, we're unraveling the mysteries of the last couple hundred years about what's happened, who's behind the scenes running things, how it is this economic machine juggernaut of the world runs, how it is that we have played a role ourselves as victims of this thing, how it is that this man, like you made a comment there about the shipping, the drugs, and the weapons, and the gold, and all the stuff's there, and it seems like it almost seems too, well, it's first of all, what we're talking about is true. These are facts. These are not just hypotheses. But the fact that this impacts the whole world, that we would think that this would be a wake-up call to everybody on the planet. What it tells me, though, Don, is that there's a few people that are awake to this, and the rest of the people, we've went way over their heads.
Well, I think, you know, if people are really paying attention and they follow up with, you know, future shows that we do, and you know, this topic comes up quite a bit, or these topics, I should say. You know, let's not forget about the transportation of people, too, because if, you know, you've got slavery involved here, you've got the abduction of people, taking them and to other places, putting them into the theater of war, and notice that word theater, you know, it's an act, it's part of their script being enacted. But the shipping of soldiers, I think of the Boer War that occurred in South Africa, and they were shipping soldiers from Australia and New Zealand. That came out in my SHRF research, the genealogy of the Bush family. I discovered some things, and shipping is one of the main ways for a number of years that they transported people. Now they do it by airplane as well, but back in those days when they didn't have commercial airlines, people were coming into this country or being moved about the earth on ships, where they couldn't travel by land. It was all done. It's all business. It's amazing.
Well, even the Constitution addresses it. Article 1, Section 9. See, Article 1, Section 9, Subsection 1 actually talks about the importation and migration of persons. So it's there. It was codified in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So this is we live in a commercial country. We just got to figure out how to play our role and bring it back to a legitimate, just, constitutional republic, that the commerce that's operating is operating under a corporation, not an unincorporated, implied charitable trust.
Oh, okay. You were sounding like Darth Vader for a moment there, Greg, and then I realized that they were bringing a caller into the show here. So if we can pause for a moment and take a call. I don't want to get you off track.
Go ahead.
This may be pertinent to our discussion. Ron from Pennsylvania, welcome to Evident Footprint. Do you have a comment or question? We're doing great. Thank you.
Pardon me?
We're doing great. Thank you.
Oh, okay. I have a bit of a challenge here. I have a birth certificate, but it's a little late to get into that right now. I have a certificate of birth. It's an ancient one. I won't tell you how old I am or how much I weigh. But I have to take issue with the certificate of title to motor vehicle. Now, this has been brought up before a couple of years ago on another program with somebody else, and a lady was on there. I don't know if she was an attorney, and she kept insisting that the certificate of title does not denote ownership, and it certainly does. She said, we don't have title to the vehicle, the state owns it, and so forth. And I can't remember if I called in, but I think I may have at the time, and I'll run this by you if I can have the continuity for about 30 seconds.
Okay.
I have several vehicles, and they all have titles that are worded the same. Now, the script may be a little different design or so forth. Certificate of title. Now, if you break the words down, as you do in medicine, certificate is an inanimate object that certifies and declares something. Well, what's a certify? Certificate of authenticity or compliance? No. Certificate of title. So that title is an enumeration. So title of what? It descript in the vehicle or in the on the document. Going to the end, barring any liens that somebody would have against your property. Further on down, it is signed by the Secretary of Transportation, in this case, Pennsylvania. Now, I can't speak for all states, but the Secretary of Transportation is not only an employee, he is a trustee, and he is Pennsylvania for all purposes of law within the realm of the department he works in. He has no voice in game commission or gaming or highways fixing and different things like that. Now, on there, any claim to that vehicle is completely relinquished by Pennsylvania in that it says, stamped by him, saying that VIN number so-and-so, only one vehicle in the world with that number, is the property of me. So any claim the state of Pennsylvania or the Commonwealth will have to that is out the window. He is the government saying that is your property. Now, under Pennsylvania law, owners of vehicles are required to have insurance. So that further affirms that I own the thing. Now, if I wanted to scrap that vehicle, say something's wrong with it, and I want to send it to the junkyard, the junk guy will not take that vehicle without a title. He's forbidden from doing so. Now, if in a case, let's take an example of a drunk driver, which I've arrested a few years ago. We don't take possession of their vehicles. We just take temporary custody. Us and the courts are forbidden from confiscating and taking possession or ownership of that vehicle. We just take temporary custody. It was at one time, the guys come later on, several hours later, and bring somebody to take them to the scene. They take their cars back until they start getting locked. And in some cases, they smash them up again. Well, the court won't even take, when this guy's arraigned and he goes through his penalization or whatever it happens to be and so forth, the court is forbidden from taking that vehicle as payment or anything else. The court has no possession, and neither does the state government. So I have to challenge the ownership of the vehicle. The state actually owns it. The state does not own the vehicle. Now, why the wording may be different, I've never seen title or certificate of title, which I have, but I've never seen an actual title, so I can't attest to what the document looks like. At the point of buying the vehicle, the manufacturer and the state has given up everything if they owned it to begin with. There is a paper trail in the chain there. So this would be, I think, an argument they can't defend against, because if the state at the end of your document is saying you own the vehicle, they can't say they do. Two people can't own the same thing because there's a liability issue. You know,
mm-hmm.
What's your take on that? Hello,
Greg. You want to comment on that, Greg?
Yeah, let me jump in on a couple of points. I can't answer all of them directly, but I'll answer based on what knowledge that I have. So I may be wrong. I think I'm right on a couple points. I have a friend of mine in Iowa who purchased a brand new vehicle, I think last year or the year before, and went down with cash and also did an initial purchase, I think, with a certain amount of silver. Maybe it was 21 silver ounces or something as part of the purchase, paid the rest of it in cash. And when he went to the finance department there in the dealership to
to run this thing through, he insisted, first of all, he wanted to make sure that the dealership actually controlled at that time the manufacturer's statement of origin, which would equate to the birth certificate for the automobile. That comes with every single automobile or truck that goes to a dealership to be sold, and no matter whether it's a little tiny car all the way up to a semi, all those have got that manufacturer's statement of origin. And my friend said he had to make these people jump through hoops and do all kinds of stuff, but he actually, before he left the dealership that day, he had the manufacturer's statement of origin, which was not title, but, like I said, the equivalent of the birth certificate that would have been registered there in the state capital. Now, again, all the significance of that, I'm not quite clear on all of it. I'm not the expert on that. The other aspect of this that's troubling me is that that regardless of whether we have control of the vehicle or we claim we own it, or even if the state says we own it, by virtue of the fact that when you go into a courtroom, that courtroom is presuming one way or the other that it has jurisdiction over something, whether it's you or a name or some entity that's somehow related through that name, that court is making a presumption of control. Because I've got a variety of cases that I've monitored over the past few months, one of which took place in November, where a friend of mine was in court and a judge was about ready to have him arrested for contempt of court because he would not enter the bar and he would not comply with what he was being told to do in that courtroom. And my friend kept insisting that they were violating, there was no way that they could go forward with that because he'd already terminated that issue. But they presumed they had control. And he was about ready to be arrested. There were four bailiffs there, one of which was right behind him with his hand on a taser, ready to arrest him. And then my friend said the magic words. And the magic words were, because the judge at this point was very upset and was actually accused the man, said that you're a U.S. citizen and you must obey the rules of the United States, and as a citizen of the United States, you must obey the laws or the rules of this court. And my friend said specifically, I object. I think he objected first. And the judge says, well, what do you object to? And he says, objecting to all this procedure that you've got on here. But specifically, you have a piece of paper in the file there that I filed. And again, the name of this document is irrelevant. It's just that one of the documents that he filed in there stated that, and he says on the document it says that I am not a 14th Amendment United States citizen. Now, the judge just told him that he is a United States citizen and he had to obey everything. My friend said that he filed a record there just stating that he was not. I am not a 14th Amendment United States citizen. Then he continued and he said, therefore, you have the completely wrong perception of what my status is. Now, the same judge, who's one of the top judges in our county, went from nearly having this guy arrested for contempt of court to silence for 10 seconds. At the end of the 10 seconds, the judge, waiting for my friend to say something more to identify really who he was and what he wanted, turned to the prosecutor and said, quote, we may have difficulty proceeding with this case. Now, my friend was on the defensive. He was a defendant in a case where he was accused of assaulting a police officer, which he didn't do. But anyways, that was the accusation. Well, and so the point is, something happened about a jurisdictional issue from what was presumed to what was given, at least verbal evidence of it not being so. Finally, after another 10-second silence, my friend not speaking and not really knowing what to say to close the matter out at that time, knows now what to do, but at the time didn't know what to do. The judge then, in a very calm voice, turns to the public defender who'd been trying to withdraw and says to him, do you have any objection to withdrawing from this case? And the judge said no, and the public defender said no, Your Honor. The bottom line is, I saw a judge having full control of the courtroom with the presumption that he had control of everything in that courtroom, especially including the man who somehow got attached, whether it's through the birth certificate or through some other means, to the court having jurisdiction, with which he was on a 14th Amendment plane, with which he was on the same plane with the judge and the attorneys, to a man who now, at the very least, had a different status on a different plane than the one that had been presumed during the first 6 minutes of that court procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm saying in the long term of that is something is existing separate, whether with the car, with the evidence I have with my friend with the manufacturer's statement of origin in his possession in his own safe, or the man being in court rebutting the presumption of him being the 14th Amendment citizen. Something took place that put two of my friends, one was regarding the car and one regarding this court case, on a higher plane than that of the court. And, of course, we all know that the court is the gatekeeper. Attorney is the gatekeeper.
Well, Greg, I always refer to the judge as the banker, okay?
Yes,
he's the banker. And so what this litigant actually did in the court, or, you know, they like to call him the defendant, he basically instructed the judge that he wasn't party to the title over him.
May I add?
Yes, right.
Okay.
That's right.
Go ahead, Ron.
All right. I have heard of that being done a few times before. I can't know over the years with success. Now, it could be, I know for sure, if you go into court, which I have, the judge is going to tell you how to run the case. That's not going to work. But it could be, in this case in Pennsylvania, and I can't speak for them all, perhaps this jurisdiction feels there's a presumption there over having jurisdiction over the individual, and they know that they have relinquished any possession or jurisdiction over the vehicle itself, and so note that on the document. Now, I don't know that for sure, but I know that they cannot take ownership with it unless it's a lien or to satisfy a fine, but they have to go through a procedure. So as far as they're concerned, the state does not own the vehicle, and they have permitted the document to be printed and signed reflecting exactly that on that paper. Now, when you go into the courtroom, it may be a whole different matter, but it may be something to ponder over and do some study into on a 14th Amendment of citizen rights, and that may be a whole different ballgame.
Well, if they're the ownership by title or certificate or license or whatever, then they should incur all of the liability. And if they do have the liability, then as Greg suggested more at the top of the show, we have recourse.
Right. Nobody has brought this up, as far as I know, in any of the programs over if the state, as this woman had stated a few years ago, if the state is actually the owner of that vehicle, then you're actually going to pay the insurance, and the state is liable for any criminal behavior or accidents thereof, regardless of who drives that thing. If they're the owner, they're responsible. So I believe that the property is mine, and if I do something with it, I'm liable for it. The state's off the hook, simple by declaration.
Mm-hmm. Well, that should be the case with anything you own.
Well, sure. You pay liability on the two properties I own, so I'm liable for it. The state isn't.
The issue boils down to this. I believe that everything that these guys have set up is under the grand illusion. This is what I mean. Look at your state constitution. Look at the original Pennsylvania constitution. Look at the one they're operating under today. The original one has boundaries. The original one has boundaries. The one they operate under today has no boundaries. There are no meets and bounds. I'm saying that there's an illusion. There's an appearance of a physical existence. But the system, I'm telling you that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania today is not operating as the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania was under when this country was founded up until
1933 to 1938. Or somewhere around there.
What's that, Ron?
I think around 33 or 34. You are right on that with the change. But I doubt if one person out of 10,000 is going to take the time to read this and file any writs as far as 14th Amendment citizen goes. But I think it's something that was definitely worth getting into. Because your local attorney is not going to do it for you.
This is a starting point. And by the way, this is my assimilation of a lot of other people's work. This is not all just mine. I see myself in a lot of ways like Don, a researcher, and compiling data that's available and trying to synthesize something into something that will work. And we've got several cases going on right now. We have a case here in Washington State. We have one in California. The one in Washington is over a driver's license issue. The one in California is actually a a probate issue, and we're hoping that that these issues, as they play out, will give more and more evidence of our status being as such, where our position is a higher position than those that operate within this court system, and we'll be able to actually move this thing forward in a practical way. And again, this is I want to state this on the record, Don, that I'm not what I'm saying tonight is not a national movement. This is not something that's going to take on a national flavor. The media is not going to pick it up. We're not going to get a large number of people, say the Ron Paul followers, to all of a sudden say, oh, well, we're going to make this move to not be 14th Amendment citizens anymore. This is an individual choice. It's kind of like that parable there, the little statement that comes after the golden rule in Matthew 7, 12, verses 13 and 14. He says in Matthew 7, 12, he says, therefore all things, whatever you desire that men should do to you, so you should do to them, for this is the law and the prophets. Enter by the narrow gate, or enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many are those entering into it. But narrow is the gate, and constricted is the way that leads away into life, and few are those who find it. This is a process for those that really absolutely have to find their way out of this purported bondage situation to freedom. And we're just looking for the tools, the practical tools, that meet the biblical mandate. That's all. And it's going to be for those that really want it.
You know, I live in, if I may continue for a moment, then I'll conclude. I live in probably the second most corrupt county in the nation, not the state. And I had a case where I represented myself in the early part of 2007 before my father passed away on Easter Sunday of that year. And I didn't want to drag him into the situation, although he was a property owner at the time. You still there? You still there?
Hello, Ron. I'm here. I got knocked off the air. So obviously we got some major truth coming out tonight. So I have to apologize now. I take it Greg has been knocked off too. I missed what you said. So if you could sort of just recap briefly.
Right. Okay. Very quickly. Before my father passed, I represented myself in court, and I had to hurriedly prepare. Didn't have my opinions and all that kind of thing. But what two things irritated the judge? Number one is I signed a pleuris oath, which means I didn't have any money. You're going to pay for it. And second of all, I represented myself, which means I can't be disbarred or lose my license because I don't have it. And with that and the area I live in being the second most corrupt in the nation, somebody's really got their hands full if they want to do study, because they're going to have to spend a hell of a lot more time in a law library than Clarence Darrow ever did. So when Pappas, Greg Pappas had mentioned about that, it's going to take a lot of due diligence on the part of most people and have the desire to want to study and really read what the law says, in order to go into these jurisdictions that you hope you never do, knowing you're playing against a stacked deck and trying to prevail. But we all have the right. The court shall be open to all. But when you go in there, it's like going into a mouth of a lion. You don't know if he's hungry or not. So I'll conclude with that. And I do wish more people would take an active interest in pursuit in this endeavor, because there's only one way we're going to turn it down other than with rope and ammunition. And that's through the courts.
Yes. Well, Lee Brobst came out with this distinction of two clauses that that state whether or not we are under the jurisdiction or not. In other words, we can claim it by the assertion that we are not this fictitious entity, but we are a person distinct from that. So, Ron,
okay,
I want to thank you for your call here. I want to see if we can't get Greg on just for a moment to close out the show here. I didn't anticipate
okay,
this interruption.
Okay, I'll conclude in case there's an electronic problem. I'll catch up with you another time, Don. Thank
okay, thanks, Ron. Have a good evening.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to try briefly to see if we can get Greg Pappas back on the line here. Our communications went down, which happens from time to time. A lot of truth coming out on tonight's show. And I'm not hearing if Greg is here.
I'm here, Don. Yes, I'm here.
Oh, there. Okay, now I'm hearing him. Okay. I got knocked off. I don't know if you did.
Yeah, I got knocked off too. Yes.
Okay.
Ron was telling his segment about his father.
Yeah, I didn't even hear that. I was making a statement at that moment, and it just cut off. So, Ron just left us, but he brought up an issue about his father. I think he did that on a past show also.
Yeah, I remember that. Yes.
Yeah. Basically, this is it under Article 4, Clause 1 and Clause 2? Are those the two clauses that Lee Brobst refers to?
It's Article
regarding
4, yeah, Article 4, Clause 3, Paragraph 1 and 2, yes.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's it. Paragraph 1 and 2 of Clause 3, okay,
yeah.
Or Section 3, we could say.
And the first one defines the actual, that what a state is. It actually has to have meets and bounds, borders, and that you can't overlap them, and if there is a variance in the states, it must meet with both state legislatures have to agree and the Congress has to agree. In other words, you can't just go changing things. So now that we're operating under a separate system, Lee would allude to the fact that it's the second paragraph, when it says the territory, is what this thing is operating under, and territories without meets and bounds. And that's why, like, if you look at Washington states or Idaho or California or Ohio or Pennsylvania, you look at any of the their constitutions they're operating under today, there are no borders. There are no physical borders. That's all part of this unincorporated implied charitable trust.
Mm-hmm. So all these fictions about, you know, state lines and community lines and, you know, incorporations, it's fiction then.
They're, right. In other words, we want the corporations. The original states were incorporated. What we have today is not. This thing that operates today is like I said, it's unincorporated. And that's, for me, this took me a long time to get this through my head because somehow I've been convinced that corporations were bad. But corporations, as this country was set up, were good. The thing that operates today is bad, and it's unincorporated. And we've been brought in as parties to it where we receive the benefits. And this has been the basis of our discussion, that we have been victimized by our ignorance.
Yeah, well, it all boils down to they have surreptitiously assigned liability for everything they do to us.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It doesn't matter what they do, it's always a liability of the people, yet the people do not receive any benefit.
That's what
they're not the beneficiaries of the secret trust.
Right, these guys that run, the trustees now have made themselves beneficiaries of everything, and they've taken it control for themselves, left us a liability, and of course they come along and say, we have a national emergency, you all need to join the army and go die for us because you're now have to go pay your liability. All we have to do is wake up and go, wait a minute, that's not me. And whatever it is that you think you got there is not me, and don't go. But we, of course, got to do our patriotic duties for everything and go play these games. That's why I believe this is a major wake-up call based on the love of God. If we follow the love of God, we will wake up. We will not participate. But it boils back down to that individual choice, Don.
Okay. Well, Greg, we're out of time. We've got to end the show. I apologize for the interruption, or maybe... maybe the NSA should apologize for the interruption. We don't know. Maybe it's not them. Maybe it's Homeland Security. You know? But we'll try to find out who was behind it. In the meantime, you'll be with us again on the 26th, Tuesday the 26th of May. So I'm looking forward to your next interview. And I want to let you know, and the listening audience, that Sam Sewell from American Grand Jury will be with us again on the 18th. That's next Monday. So we'll be talking about the execution of our constitutional rights in stopping all this crime or addressing the crime that's occurring.
Right.
And it's just unimaginable how much crime is occurring right now.
Yep.
By the very people that want to enslave us and have to an extent. But what we talked about tonight is certainly the way we should recognize what rights we really have to do. And these are God-given rights we're talking about.
Absolutely. That's as Jefferson alluded to them in the Declaration of Independence, right? Laws of nature and nature's God. Yep.
Okay. Well, Greg, I thank you for being on the show twice tonight. And
thank you, Don. It's been great. I love doing this fast-paced discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we'll say goodnight to our listening audience. You have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. And tonight's special guest, Greg Pappas. He'll be with us again on the 26th of May. Be sure to tune in for that and other shows. Tomorrow, my special guest will be Mr. Ken Adachi. Don't want to miss that show either. In the meantime, special thanks to Don Newsom and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. Seth Hendrick on the sound and Don Newsom on the sound. And special thanks to you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Have a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.